Welcome to this podcast of the IFRS Interpretation Committee. I'm Bob Garnett, the committee's chairman, and with me to discuss some of the topics from the November 2010 meeting are Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities, and Lucy Wright, Project Manager.
Hello.
Over the past couple of days, we've looked at quite a number of issues, but there are perhaps four that are worthy of mention in different ways. One of them is our trusted old friend, Michael, the put options written over non-controlling interests.
Yes.
This has been exercising the minds of quite a number of people, regulators, investors, preparers, and not surprisingly, auditors. Part of the problem in their mind seems to be that the board, in its update to IAS 27 recently, required transactions between controlling and non-controlling interests to be accounted for as if they were part of equity. The implication of that being that equity values don't change. But IAS 32, our old friend, looks at these put options, if they're written to be settled in cash, as liabilities, with the change in the liability going through profit and loss. So how are we going to deal with this anomalous position?
Yes, well, this is an issue that, as you say, the Interpretations Committee has been looking at for a little while and had published a tentative agenda decision in September recommending that this issue be looked at by the board as part of its liability equity project. Now, as with all of our tentative agenda decisions, they're open for comment, and we had quite a number of comment letters received this time, and a number of those really saying that either the board or the committee needed to do something about the problems that are arising with this. There is a lot of diversity in practice, and that diversity really is coming from the fact that we have the IAS 27, as you say, which talks about recognising transactions with equity holders through equity, whereas IAS 39 requiring the remeasurement of financial liabilities through profit or loss. And so when we have these financial liabilities for put options, should they be remeasured through profit or loss, or should they be remeasured through equity? Now, I think the board would consider addressing this through its liabilities equity project, but that project is really not going to be able to receive very much board attention until after June of next year, and there is a concern that progress should be made more quickly than that. So what the committee has suggested that it do is perhaps explore a couple of different ways in which this could be addressed. One, perhaps exploring a presentation solution in which perhaps the change in the measurement of the financial liability for these particular instruments be recognised in equity rather than recognised in profit or loss. The other possible solution that it thought it might explore would be whether perhaps the board should amend the measurement requirements for these particular instruments to require a sort of fair value or net measurement of them in the same way as a derivative would be measured, which would perhaps lead to less volatility for these fair value options than we see at the moment with the gross liability.
So in the case of an option that's given to what we used to call a minority shareholder, to say, in effect, you've got the first right of refusal, but you've also got the right to force me to pay you at whatever the market price is when you want to sell out, that those sort of put options have a fair value that is pretty close to zero. It's a benefit of liquidity, so there wouldn't be much volatility going through there. But I suppose if somebody has written a fixed price put, then even though at the moment there's really no value change going through, that when you look at the value of that option, as the market price goes down, then that option becomes very valuable to the holder, and that becomes a more significant liability. So we might still have some volatility.
We would, but I think in those circumstances, people see that there is some meaning to that change in the liability, because if you're locked into a particular price to purchase some shares, then as the value of those shares changes, so the contract is either moving in or out of the money, and so therefore there is a real change in value there that, if reflected through profit or loss, would be reflective of what many people see as the economic reality. And the concern with the current arrangement is that we get a change in the measurement of the gross liability, the redemption amount, when in fact, as you say, there's little or no intrinsic value to these particular options when they're priced at fair value of the shares to be purchased.
Well, I hope our listeners are reassured that the Interpretations Committee is paying attention to economic reality as well as just improving financial reporting. Maybe we can turn, Lucy, to you now. Over the past couple of meetings, we've actually had two issues relating to the classification of debt. One that came up that we actually confirmed this time, that if the lender has the right to call on demand its loan, even though its term might have been originally for long term, that is classified as a current liability. But now we've had another question that's come in. I'm beginning to get alarmed that the world is uncertain about what is current and what is non-current now. But it seems to be a little bit more intriguing, this new one. And that's really the question of if a loan is going to be refinanced or rolled over, whether, if that agreement has been made by the reporting date, by the end of the year, that even though the loan itself would have to be repaid within, say, 12 months of the balance sheet date, but the refinancing or the rolling over arrangement enables it to be classified as non-current. But my recollection is the committee wasn't actually completely united on all aspects of this question. Could you just fill this in a little bit?
Yes, Bob. The paragraph you're referring to is a tricky one in IS 1 of paragraph 73. And we had a very robust and, I thought, a very interesting discussion on this, albeit it was late in the day yesterday. But it seemed clear from the committee discussions that if a loan is rolled over or refinanced with the same lender on similar terms, it could be classified as non-current. However, it was not clear if a different lender was involved as to what that classification would be. So we have agreed to research the extent to which there is diversity in practice around this. And as you say, it is a concern as to what people actually understand in terms of current and non-current when it comes to liabilities. And we've agreed to bring back that research to the January committee meeting.
I should look forward to that one coming back. The representative of the investors who is at the committee meeting as well, of course, expressed some views that absent the requirements of IS1, what in fact she would like to see as being good financial reporting.
Yes.
And we do have within existing IFRS 7, of course, some requirement for disclosure about the liquidity and the maturity of debts and how they may be handled. So perhaps we will find a way of improving and clarifying at the same time, getting information that the investors find is useful. But it's going to be a tough time for you, I think, Lucy, so you have our best wishes on that one.
Thank you.
Michael, just to go back to one of our old chestnuts that came up several meetings ago but doesn't ever seem to want to go away, the question of deferred tax, and particularly if there is such a thing as a deferred tax asset that can arise when you impair an available for sale debt security. I see from the papers that we've had quite a lot of correspondence, quite a lot of outreach with people who are affected by this. What's the latest thinking on this now?
Okay, well, this issue is, of course, related to where we've got an AFS available for sale debt security that is recorded at fair value, but the market value has declined, and so we've got an impairment that we've recognised on this. But when it's in a circumstance where the holder of this debt security is intending to hold it to maturity, so that it will collect the interest income and collect the principal repayments on this asset, that it will end up recovering the whole of the original value. And so the impairment is one that is reflected in the financial statements, but one that is not expected to be reflected through loss of cash flows in the future. So by maturity, the full value would be recovered. Now, the issue here is that during this interim period, when we've got a reduced fair value, whether that reduced fair value and the impairment that has been reflected in the financial statements, whether that should lead to a deferred tax asset being recognised. Now, IAS 12 is quite a rules-based standard and does require that certain criteria are met in order to recognise a deferred tax asset. Now, I think everyone's agreed that there is a temporary difference that would potentially lead to the recognition of a deferred tax asset for these instruments. The question, though, is do we meet the recognition criteria to be able to recognise one of these deferred tax assets? And the requirements of the standard are that there needs to be future taxable income against which the loss, the deductible temporary difference that we've identified, will be able to be utilised in order to get this tax recovery. Now, the issue is shouldn't be too much of a problem where the entity that's holding this instrument has got sufficient taxable profits in the future that it expects to be able to realise. The question really arises when there's losses brought forward and there's a prediction of further losses in the future, taxable losses, as to whether simply the automatic reversal that is expected to happen with the fair value on these instruments, whether that is sufficient in its own right to be able to recognise a deferred tax asset. And that's where the committee, when it was looking at this, felt no, that on its own is not sufficient. You need to be able to identify the sorts of future taxable profits that the standard talks about to be able to recognise the deferred tax asset. And so we did have a lot of correspondence on this issue, and I think the committees realised that there's been quite some diversity in the way in which the tax standard has been read, and that it really would be worth clarifying what is required by the tax standard and making those clarifications through an annual improvement. So the committee at this meeting has decided, you know, let's propose a change to the board for it to revise the tax standard to make clear the circumstances in which deferred tax assets can be recognised in these sorts of situations.
Always a difficult sort of circumstance, you know, because deferred tax in many people's minds is just a figment of an accountant's creation. So whether the asset is really collectible or not through the reversal is going to be an awkward question. But I can see that you're leading towards a situation that will say, well, let's use some common sense and rules, and if it's a business that is expecting to make profits in the future, it doesn't have any large losses, then you would make the judgments about recognition of the asset on the same basis as you would for any other type of deferred tax. The fact that some of these businesses unfortunately suffered very heavy losses during the global financial crisis, that they can't just presume that for these individual items, the fact that it will reverse, that they can treat those separately from all of the other losses. So the big picture view is the important one here, yes. I guess. All right. Now, speaking of the big picture, of course, Lucy, we've spoken quite a lot about recognition and measurement. Presentation is always the end result of where we are. And sometimes we find that we've got our standards where the staff, and who've done a great job, of course, as you continue to do, but have written some helpful but non-authoritative illustrative material to give an indication of how companies might present certain types of information. But it seems that sometimes this helpful information is being taken almost as a rigid rule that encapsulates everything that should be disclosed, but nothing else to be disclosed. We had a question that came in on IS 41 on agriculture for the presentation of the growth in biological transformation. It's a marvellous term, is that? But anyway. And that seems to have inhibited people from reporting revenue. So what on earth are we going to do about this? Are we trying to be helpful?
Well, Bob, I think it was very interesting to see IS 41 pop up on our agenda because we haven't had it for a while. I think the trick really is, with these illustrative examples, to read the disclaimers that are attached to them insofar as they aren't expected to be authoritative and quite possibly not a complete representation of everything that needs to be put into a particular set of accounts, and this is a good example of that. And while we recognise that illustrative examples are helpful to our constituents, we think that the constituents should view them in the light in which they were originally developed. And so the committee at this stage has decided not to take any action with respect to this request.
All right, so the message that we can put out to the world at large then is that we can be helpful by illustrating material, but that doesn't mean you should forget about the requirements of the standards themselves.
Indeed, and IS 41 is not the only standard which has illustrative examples attached to it, so I think it is a fairly pervasive point to take note of.
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, Michael and Lucy, for joining us on this podcast. Just to remind our listeners that the next meeting of the IFRS Interpretations Committee will only be in 2011, but it'll be on the 6th and 7th of January, so you're welcome to tune in on the live webcast of that. We also draw your attention to the invitation that the trustees are offering to assist them in their review of the effectiveness of the interpretation process. So online you can go to the questionnaire that's in there, give us a rating, but please make any constructive comments and suggestions that you can. It helps the trustees to improve the organisation, its effectiveness, and also generally to improve financial reporting on a global basis. I do have to end with a traditional disclaimer, of course. This podcast presents a non-authoritative overview of some of the topics discussed at the meeting of the IFRS Interpretations Committee in November 2010. And the views that you've heard expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views of the committee. For those of you who wish to read the official record of this meeting, you should refer to the IFRIC update, which is available on the IFRS website, ifrs.org. Thank you.